Greetings and salutations, everyone. Welcome to another episode of my podcast. I'm Harold C. Connolly, Jr., an explorer of space, time, and the human experience. I do so in very specific ways, as being founding chair and professor of the Department of Geology at Rowan University in southern New Jersey, and as being mission sample scientist on OSIRIS-REx, which is NASA's New Frontiers 3 asteroid sample return mission. Today, I am coming to you from the Drake Building at the University of Arizona in Tucson, Arizona, which is the science excitement center, if you will, of the OSIRIS-REx mission. And it's my great honor to have members of the OSIRIS-REx OLA, or OSIRIS-REx Laser Altimeter, team with me today to talk about what a laser altimeter is, for those listening, why it's important. It's a contribution to the science payload from our colleagues north of the border, from Canada. And with me is Mike Daly, professor at York University, also research chair in planetary science, and Minar El-Assad, who is a research scientist at the University of British Columbia, and Jason Leon, who is instrument engineer of OLA at MDA. Thank you very much, all three of you, for coming and talking to me today. Are you excited? Not for this, but for the mission?
For the mission, I'm excited, yes.
Yeah. Tell us about OLA. Tell us what OLA is, why it's important to have OLA, because it is extremely important.
Sure. So OLA is a laser altimeter, and what a laser altimeter is it measures essentially the time that it takes a light beam to traverse the distance from OLA to the asteroid and back again. And given that time, we can calculate the distance knowing the speed of light. So OLA is a very special laser altimeter in that it has a very fast measurement rate, so it takes a lot of measurements, and it can actually point those measurements in a very dexterous manner over the whole asteroid. So in this way, we can build up the whole shape of the asteroid.
Exactly. Everything from troughs to high boulders to whatever it is.
Right. So on this mission, we have two ways of getting the shape. We have a camera-based method and the laser altimeter-based method. So the laser altimeter-based method has some advantages over the camera-based method in that it's a direct measurement. So, you know, we get a real first-order measurement to the surface. The camera-based method has advantages that we get the shapes earlier, but there's some inferred data that makes some of the features more difficult to measure. So the two methods really complement each other.
Yeah, combining them together give you a much thorough concept of the surface of the moon.
Right.
So tell us your role. You've been on this mission for some time now.
Yeah, we started this in 2008, so
yeah, right.
I put the concept together for OLA with some colleagues, and now I'm the instrument engineer leading this contribution from OLA. So it's been a long road to get here, and we got in December our first data set, so we knew the instrument was working, unlike some of the other instruments. You know, like the cameras where there were images along the way, we didn't have anything to reflect off of, so our first data set was in December, and our first really dense data set we just got recently.
Just got the other day. Yeah. So, it's really exciting.
So it's really cool.
Yeah. So, Jason, tell us what you do on the mission. What is your role?
I work for the company that built the OLA instrument. And I am, my role is called instrument engineer, and I'm responsible for, as OLA is operating, as we get data, I go in and make sure that the instrument is healthy and functioning from an engineering perspective. Mike here is all about the science side. I'm all about keeping the instrument healthy and making sure it's being used properly.
Like, give me an example of what healthy means in this case.
So, for example, if the lasers have to operate at a very specific temperature range.
Mm.
And there is a thermal control subsystem within Ola. It's that's designed to maintain those temperature ranges. And we get temperature data back as Ola operates. So it's my job to, for example, look at this temperature data and make sure that the laser is at a healthy temperature. That's just an example.
That's a great example. That's perfect. Manar.
Hi.
Tell us, what is your role on the project of Ola?
Oh.
Of course, OSIRIS-REx.
My role is whatever Mike Daly wants me to do.
Okay. But, that's fair enough.
That's the public answer.
What is your passion here as well at the same time?
Ola, I'm mostly doing post-processing of the data and looking at anything that might be interesting, whether it's on-body or off-body. So looking at the details of the geology and the shape. And also I'm looking at synthesizing the Ola-based measurements with the SBC-based or the image-based shape models.
Image-based shape, yeah.
Yeah, so...
I think people don't realize when you get to a planetary body, such as an asteroid, you have to create a shape model. You may, in our case, have some construct of the shape model from radar before you arrive at the asteroid, but there's a whole series of executions that have to go on with the system that enable you to be able to move in and orbit, in this case, the asteroid. And part of that is getting the mass distribution understood and, of course, the shape of the asteroid. And Ola is going to help us refine that entire shape model in the end.
Yeah, the shape is much more important than people are probably, as you say, than people are probably aware of, because on the Earth, you know, it's much more easy to evaluate the geology or based on a flat map. But on a small body like this, where the accelerations because the asteroid is rotating and the accelerations due to gravity are of the same order, the shape is really very important in calculating exactly where the slopes are and how things would move on the surface of the asteroid. And it's really a fundamental data product that we drape all our other science observations on. So it's important from a science perspective, and as you say, it's also important to navigate the spacecraft.
Right. As kind of a loose example, it's one thing to be looking at the Rocky Mountains from Denver as you're driving towards them. It's another thing to be sitting in Boulder and looking at them. You get a whole different perspective. You know they're mountains, but that's about all you know. When you get close enough, you can start ironing out details. So you were going to add something else? Sorry.
You said something about Ola refining the shape that is derived from the images. And especially with the high density Ola measurements that we got last week, you could see a lot of details such as, you know, distributions of small rocks that will also help not only navigating the spacecraft, but selecting sample site.
Bingo. That's the big thing, isn't it? Collecting a sample and bringing it home.
Very interested in the sample, apparently.
Yeah, apparently. As mission sample scientist, I would be. That's right, yeah. As the first mission sample scientist in exploration history. Correct. Sample site selection. And Ola will feed into that in a very important fashion, without question. Because there are four maps we make for the process of selecting a sample. And without question, it feeds into really all four. I don't know if it's all in the pipeline for all four, but it certainly does feed into all four. I can't remember. Certainly remember in three of them anyway. Right. Well, how did you get to be involved in OSIRIS-REx? I mean, you said you put a proposal together, and I guess you threw it to Mike Drake with colleagues.
Kind of. It actually is a little bit of an offshoot of a previous mission that we did with University of Arizona. So,
so you had this history here.
There's history,
Okay,
right?
Okay.
So history is with the Phoenix Mars mission. So
right.
The Phoenix Mars mission started when Canada wanted to contribute to exploration, and there was a Mars Scout opportunity. And so at that time, I called up Peter Smith, who was at the University of Arizona, and said, "What can Canada put on your lander?" And so what we ended up putting on the lander was a pressure and temperature measurement system, the pressure measurement system we did with the Finnish Meteorological Institute. And then the atmospheric LIDAR. So this is a different kind of LIDAR, and then it wasn't set up to measure to a hard target. It was set up to measure distribution of dust and clouds in the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. So we actually, I led the engineering team and was the lead engineer for that contribution. And we had an interesting Canadian discovery there. We saw snow falling on the surface of Mars with LIDAR.
Okay.
So the connection then was, you know, there was a good working relationship with the University of Arizona. So people from here called me when they were putting this mission together. And we thought about the LIDAR, given the LIDAR history. Now, the direct connection with that instrument was OLA has two lasers in it.
Mm-hmm.
So it has a high-energy laser that operates at 100 times per second and a low-energy laser that operates at 10,000 times per second, so 10,000 measurements a second. So the 100 measurement a second laser is a direct offshoot, really a copy with a couple of minor changes of the laser that we sent to Mars.
Mm.
So we melded that with another instrument that we had built for another Earth orbital mission, and that's how we got OLA. So it was a combination of some hardware history and some working history with the people here at the University of Arizona.
Okay, cool. That's the same year I became involved in OSIRIS-REx. Did you know the story? Yeah, it's very interesting because obviously Dante and I, the PI, have been friends for over 20 years now, but I've been coming here for almost 20. Working at the University of Arizona, and I was working on a project with Tim McCoy, Jess Sunshine from the University of Maryland, and Bobby Buss from the University of Hawaii at Hilo. So Bobby, he's an observer of asteroids, found a lot of asteroids in the old-fashioned way, and has a huge catalog of them, and Jess Sunshine is a spectroscopist. Of course, Tim McCoy is the national curator of meteorites, and you didn't do that, did you? Sorry, I'm having technical difficulties here. Just going to fix for a second. Okay, there we go. Okay, back to discussion. This won't be edited. So, and we worked on a project of looking at CAIs, calcium-rich, aluminum-rich inclusions, which are the first rocks to form in the solar system within chondrites. And I did the petrography, cored them out. Jess and her team did the spectroscopy. And then we compared it to a small group of asteroids. And long story short, it became a science paper. And after that, Dante said to me, wow, you're no longer a myopic meteoriticist who only studies chondrules. Would you like to be on OSIRIS-REx? And Mike invited me, and boom, that was it. So literally, it was in May of 2008. I remember it well. How about you, Jason?
Well, I wasn't actually involved in the design and building of the instrument. I actually got involved in the latest phase of on-orbit operations. I saw this opportunity and I jumped on it, because I didn't want to miss out on something. It was pretty exciting. So, my involvement is fairly recent, but there's been lots of people at my company that have designed and built this great instrument, and I'm just pretty much standing on their shoulders.
You get to see the cool part.
Yeah, exactly. You get to see the return. Minna?
My first day of involvement with OSIRIS-REx was launch.
Launch? Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So I got to see it.
You got to go, you watched the launch.
Yeah.
Right? Oh, wow.
And
how'd you do that?
You didn't do it?
No, I was there, but how did you get invited to that?
So I work with Dr. Catherine Johnson, who is a deputy instrument scientist for OLA.
Yeah.
And I've been working in her group on different projects on and off since 2011.
Okay.
And when she said that she needed help with the OSIRIS-REx mission, I read up on it and decided to join. And so that was when I started working, was right before the launch. And so I got invited to launch and got to see it.
Fantastic.
Which was a great way to start working on a mission, honestly.
Yeah, I guess so. That's one way to really stimulate you to be interested in the mission is to go to an Atlas V launch. You were there, right?
I was.
Yeah, I guess you were not there. You hadn't been on board yet. Yeah, I was there too, and I still remember it. Like, I was after they said the switching to onboard power, I knew we were good to go unless something really ridiculous happened, right? So I started getting really nervous, and I'm sitting in the bleachers, and I had my iPhone, and then, you know, when it started going up, I, you know, was filming it with the video. And then I started crying so hard, I couldn't actually see anything in front of me. So all these people are putting their hands on my shoulder and everything. And somehow I managed to get it without losing sight of it.
Yeah. I saw the Phoenix launch too, but the OSIRIS-REx launch was a little nicer because it was in the daytime. The Phoenix one we had to get up in the middle of the night for. Which the night launch is cool, but the eyes were a little bleary.
Yeah.
I don't know if you saw, but I have a picture of my colleague at the American Museum of Natural History's father took on a commercial airline, Jackie Flaherty. He was coming up from Miami, just coincidental, as OSIRIS-REx launched.
Oh.
So you could actually see the, you know, the arc and the launch trajectory and everything. It was totally, totally cool.
Something special. Yeah. I've never seen a rocket launch.
You have to go sometime.
I know. It's a, it's definitely a bucket list.
It's incredibly impressive. Yeah. I went down for STS-122, the launch of Space Shuttle 122. Stan Love is an astronaut, and Stan was on that mission, and we were postdocs together and became friends together at Caltech back in, starting in 96. So,
yeah. When we did the Phoenix launch, it was within a week of Dave Williams' launch on the shuttle, so we saw that.
You saw that too. Oh, that's great. That's great. So tell me what from your perspective, each one of you, or together, or what is going to really sort of make you extremely excited as we continue to explore the asteroid with respect to what we might find? Is there something?
Well, we're just getting over the excitement of seeing the first dense OLA data set. So,
fair enough. It works.
Well, it works, and you think about these things, and you plan for these data sets. And when we planned for the data set from OLA, you know, we were expecting Bennu to be a little more cooperative, you know, a little smoother, and in some ways more boring from an altimetry perspective.
Right.
So then we get this actual data set, and, you know, I'm not really a excitable person, but I got to tell you, it was cool.
Well,
you know, we're seeing all these little features, and this data set we just got was an extra data set that was unplanned. So our first dense data set was something we didn't really expect until recently, and it really exceeded my expectations.
Mm.
So, but in terms of what we're looking for in the future, I'm two things really. I'm looking for the first global shape from OLA, which is what we'll get in the summer from our orbital B phase, we call it.
Right.
And then I'm looking for the really high resolution OLA data set from the sample site.
Yeah, me too.
Because I think we'll do the best there. So.
Yeah, it turned out Bennu is not exactly 100% complying with our engineering requirements. So yeah.
But
a little bit more tricky than we expected. Yeah.
I think it's also more interesting than we may have expected from a science perspective. So.
Well, that's right. It's given us many, many surprises that are extremely exciting and wonderful. So that's the point of exploring, isn't it? It's to find surprises, right? I mean,
yeah.
Why go somewhere new if you're not going to be surprised by something, right?
That's why I do this.
Yeah.
You know, when we saw the Phoenix landing, it was it took me back to, I remember sitting in front of the TV when Viking landed.
Oh, right.
You know, and that feeling of seeing something that no one's ever seen before is really cool. And so I forgot all the pain of having done that project, and that's really the reason for doing this project.
Yeah, it reminds me, I teach a gateway course to geology, 100 level course, which is sort of a history of space exploration globally, not just the U.S. And one of the things I do is I bring in, when we talk about Voyager, because how can you not talk about Voyager 1 or 2, right? It's sort of set the standard for a lot of exploration. So I bring in this VHS tape, and I show the students this VHS tape. And they said to me, what is that? I said, well, that's a VHS tape. That's an old videotape, how we used to record off the television in the old days. And they're like, oh, I heard about that. And let's see what it says on there. It says Voyager. That's my recording from public television of the data that was being transmitted to JPL that was being picked up by public television, and they had a whole day where public television only showed the images coming from Voyager. That would never happen in today's world. But I still have it on my shelf. Yeah.
Well, my difficult thing to describe, like your VHS tape, is one of the things Ola does is it has a two-dimensional scanning mirror, so it can scan, you know, both up and down and side to side and both at the same time. So one of the orbital B phase that we talk about, where we're going to do the very high density global shape of the asteroid, we do something that's very similar to how an old cathode ray tube television works. So I need to find a new way to describe this to students,
because they don't know what a clue.
They have no idea.
Yeah, they don't. Some of them will get to the point where they won't even know what a plasma TV is. Yeah. So let's switch a little bit more to the personal side, just because this is an international mission with lots of partners from many different countries. So you guys are from Canada. So I happen to know that you originally are from Saudi Arabia.
Yes.
Right? So you moved to Canada to go to school.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that, if you will.
I moved to Canada in 2009 to start my undergraduate degree at UBC. And I told you previously that I started working with Catherine in 2011, right. So as a second year undergraduate assistant. And back then she was working on the Messenger mission to Mercury.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And so that was my first introduction to planetary missions, and I was not as involved as I am right now in OSIRIS, but very much enjoyed it. And after that, I went back to Saudi after graduating, worked in oil and gas for almost 2 years, but didn't quite enjoy it as much as I enjoyed.
You missed the cold weather?
Well, weather was minor. It's mostly space that I missed.
Yeah, okay, fair enough.
Vancouver doesn't get cold weather like other places in Canada.
This is true, I guess. Yeah, this is true. Yeah. Actually, yeah, it's beautiful there, yeah, right.
So I came back and I started working on OSIRIS-REx, hoping to become a Canadian citizen in the near future.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful. And plan to remain in Canada, in North America in general.
Okay, wonderful. Yeah, that's great. And you're from Canada originally?
I grew up in Ottawa.
Ottawa. Well, there you go. Any comments about life, the difference between here and the Canada, because you spent a lot of time in Tucson as well.
Yeah, I spent time in Tucson, which is good for me because
we'll avoid national politics.
No national politics. But my sister actually lives in Tucson, so I only have one sibling, and so it's kind of fun for me that I get to visit on business the one place where my sister lives, so
that's great.
So it's kind
of I just learned that today, actually. Yeah, that's great. Yeah, yeah. It's so wonderful for me having friends like Dante and Kate, who I've known for years, and watching their boys grow up. And I guess it was my last trip or a trip before that Xander said to me, "When did you first meet me?" I thought that was kind of an unusual question. And I said, when you were in your mother's stomach at Perry's Steakhouse, Houston, Texas, where your parents told me they were pregnant. Now, you grew up in Canada?
Yeah, I was born in China, but my parents immigrated to Canada with me in 2000. So my parents actually live in Vancouver. And I just, I went to high school there, but went to Toronto for university and then stayed there ever since. So being down here in Tucson is nice at this time of year, as you can imagine. It's this particular trip, the day I left, there was a particularly bad snowstorm in Toronto.
Oh.
And in Vancouver, apparently.
And in Vancouver, yeah.
You got out just in time?
I got out just in time. Secretly, I'm very happy, but the official line is I feel sorry for my wife who has to shovel.
Very well put. Yeah, oh, that's great. Yeah, I have a sort of an unusual knack of just avoiding bad weather every time I fly. Mm-hmm. Got to the point where people are like, what do you do? I mean, last time I was in Sapporo, I was literally the last flight out of Sapporo to Tokyo before the blizzard hit. It was 4 days before the next flight left. Yeah, it's pretty wild. Yeah. So what would you like to tell the listeners, anything at all with respect to science, you know, your own lives related to science? And you know, one of the things I want people to know is that scientists, you know, are normal, everyday people. We have passions, we have religious viewpoints, we have cultural differences, and it's all our strength, not our weakness. So what would you like to say, if anything?
Well, I guess the easy thing to say, given that I teach both science and engineering students, is you know, it's these missions where you see both these disciplines really come together. So I've spent some of my career kind of sitting on the fence between those two disciplines and trying to sometimes translating between the two, because the ways of thinking about problems can be very different.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right.
But when you work on a mission like this, you definitely get an appreciation for both, and right. You can't do a science mission with a spacecraft without both of them working together very closely.
Absolutely. In fact, I interviewed Sarah the other day, and we were discussing that, because I never dreamed, you know, 15 years ago that I would be speaking the language of engineering, let alone learning about engineering, and wow. Was so cool. Mind you, at first it was a bit frustrating, but I got over that. Well, tell us the properties of the material so we know how to, you know, be able to better design for shake tests and for the sample return capsule coming in through the atmosphere. Well, that's why we're collecting samples, because right. We don't freaking know. but that's not a good enough answer. Not for an engineer.
Right. So my first experience with that is we were trying to measure dust and clouds in the atmosphere of Mars. Well, what do you even do to put a requirement down for that when you have no idea what you're going to find?
Right.
So engineering is all about requirements, and science is all about learning things that you have no idea how to write a requirement about.
Right, and it's great that both sides get to see the fruition of each other's endeavors. It's really, I mean, I don't know how to say how exciting it is, because I'm not a poet, but I wish I was. I might be able to express it better. Something you want to say?
On this point, it's my first time working with so closely with engineers, and I do appreciate the personal experience that I get from that, because I'm used to just getting the data and thinking about it as coming from the spacecraft as is. But then when you realize that there is so much that happens between getting, you know, coming from the spacecraft and turning into readable human data.
Great.
Makes me appreciate a lot of the effort that is put into it.
Great point.
Well, one of the things that's very different with a spacecraft instrument compared to working in the laboratory is, in the laboratory, you know, there's instruments are relatively less expensive. So, you know, if you need two instruments to do two different measurements, you grab two instruments.
Right.
But on a spacecraft, given how limited we are in space and that the instruments cost so much more, we're often pushing the very limits of what instruments can measure on spacecraft. So you have to really understand them at a very low level, more so than you might a typical laboratory instrument.
Right. And also your planning is completely different for a laboratory instrument versus a space mission instrument, because in a lab you could plan out just a few hours before you do your experiment. But on a space mission, we're planning out years in advance. Every detail, and that's the engineering that's behind that. Do you want to add something, Jason?
I'll just echo everything else has been said, but for me personally, the biggest thing, most striking thing for this experience was learning about how complex a mission like this is, which Manar already sort of alluded to. Just so many moving pieces, so many little things that if you've been working on this for a few years, then it comes second nature to you. But with somebody coming in here cold, there's like,
right?
You have no idea. And something that happens, like if you can find somebody to ask, here you go, that's the answer. But you don't know it until you've been here for a while.
Right.
So
right.
Just, it was, for me, that was a super steep learning curve, but it gives you good appreciation for it. how complex these things can be.
Including the personalities of the people that we work with, right? After a while, it does become something like one big family, and you think to yourself, oh, there such and such goes again. All right, I'm gonna wait till this is over with. Before, you know, or, oh, wow, look what this person did. Oh, fantastic. Yeah,
it's generally good on this mission.
Yeah. Actually, it really is. It's been a great pleasure for me. And part of my personal philosophy my whole life has been, and I don't do too well if I don't have this, is that I want to do something because it's fun, because I'm going to learn something. Yeah. Even if it means I push myself out of my comfort zone. I'm very uncomfortable doing something because I don't have a clue exactly what I'm doing. When it's all over with, I've learned a lot. And generally speaking, the people I work with, I've had fun. If I haven't, I don't really want to work with them again.
Yeah.
So I have one more or less round of questions that just dawned on me about your background. So your undergraduate degree and graduate degree were in what?
Again, engineering physics.
Engineering physics.
So I didn't know whether I wanted to be an engineer or a scientist, so I kind of split the difference.
Right, and for both, a PhD too?
Yeah.
And you, Jason?
Something called engineering science, which is similar to engineering physics, but I went in there because there was an aerospace option.
That's right, you have aerospace.
So, that's it.
Geophysics with the focus on planetary science and math.
Ah, thus also the oil industry.
Yep.
Yeah, I see. Oh, okay. Well, I'm a bona fide geologist from an undergraduate degree and a bona fide geologist with a PhD. I'm one of the very few on the mission, actually, who's a geologist through and through. There's some geologists or earth and planetary scientists from PhDs and also some geologists from undergraduate, but there are just a few of us with PhDs in geology, so... Yeah, it's kind of fun that you're working with so many different people with so many different backgrounds, such diverse backgrounds.
Well, everybody, including the geologist, has to learn how to be a little multidisciplinary on a mission like this.
Of course,
so that's what makes it fun.
Of course, absolutely.
As you said, I find my learning curve is pretty steep at times, but that's what's enjoyable.
Yeah.
And you've always made it pleasurable. Any last words? Anybody? Anything at all? No? Well, I want to thank all three of you very much for sitting with me on this interview and letting me get to know you better, and hopefully you know a little bit something more about me, and hopefully the listeners will get a lot out of it. So, thank you.
Well, stay tuned for some more Ola data.
Yay!
Thank you.
Thank you, Harold.